Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Bonnie Michelle. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, whether it is using the power of words to speak your truth or understanding of sex in our culture to preparing the perfect mushroom soup. Politics are everywhere. On today's show, Tave Fache-Drake and Brian Delaney, hosts of the podcast Peace, Love, and Soup, celebrated National Homemade Soup Day on February 4th by chatting with fellow podcaster St. James. They made soup and talked about toxic masculinity. Kristen Thiel shares her next She-Raw solution with an introduction to Georgia Gilmore, activist and cookbook writer. Denise Kowalczyk chats with blogger and published author Jolie Brownell about her work, Me Too Girl. Lynn Finch shares another one of her inspiring stories, but first, Lady Monte returns with Permutations with interviews from recent Me Too March.
Hello, everybody. This is Lady Monte. Welcome to another installment of Permutations, where we discuss the ins and outs of sex culture from the perspective of somebody with a mutated sex chromosome, otherwise known as intersex. For this episode, I attended a Me Too Speak Out rally and march and gathered commentary from a variety of different characters about their opinions regarding a facet of our sexual narrative as human beings that is getting a lot of media attention lately. Rape culture. Where does it reside? In our psyches or our social structures? Like so much of our sexual identities can be, do we purchase access to or protection from rape culture as consumerists? How and what would this look like? How does our understanding of ourselves as sexual beings and of what sex is contribute to rape culture, but more importantly, how can we use our understandings to contribute to a culture of radical consent? Sit back and pay attention. We're about to get sexy. This is Permutations.
We understand that capitalism is a powerful tool used to uphold patriarchy and vice versa. These systems are used as cudgels to oppress women everywhere. Women of all lands must unite and stand in solidarity with one another. Not much about
you. I'd like to just talk quickly about women's fashion. I think heels, guess what? They're sexy, but they're not sexy because they make us weak.
Maybe someday I won't have to walk around with a weapon. I'm like, has anyone seen these? These are so cool.
That's why I wear these metal boots.
If women don't know about female urination devices, this is called a pee style. So check it out. They're really cool.
We want our pockets back!
Don't you want? What it does mean, however, is that when we choose our feminist heroes, we need to look beyond the wealthy celebrities, beyond mainstream female politicians who are often perpetrators of violence themselves against women both at home and abroad, in names like austerity and militarism. Women who say the word intersectionality in the same breath that they vote to authorize drone strikes, mass surveillance, and deportation.
For Permutations, how do you think capitalism and rape culture intersect with each other as far as concepts that we engage with as society?
Oh, I think they totally like just support someone another. It's like you see these things being perpetuated in all of our like mainstream media.
Okay.
And it's like everything that people buy into, and they don't even realize they're buying into because you grow up with it.
Yeah. What kind of things do you see in the media that you think can be purchased or a part of sex culture that contributes to rape culture?
I think I see it a lot in movies.
Movies.
A lot of movies and like comedy.
So for media you pay for. And how would you see like people portrayed that are being oppressed by rape culture?
So you see it as like the butt of humor jokes. You use it as just like a punchline.
I think rape culture has nothing to do with capitalism. I think it's just a human issue. That,
okay.
You know, I don't think you should involve any type of political viewpoint into respecting another person.
Okay.
There's totally separate, I feel like they're totally separate entities. It comes down to simply a human respect issue, regardless of how you identify, regardless of what political affiliation you may identify strongly with. Simply respecting another human being and honoring who they are is really what it comes down to. And people love to box those things in.
True. Got you. Would you say it's a level of concept, like ideology people are grappling with? Like, it's okay to rape people, it's okay to sell people sexuality?
Yeah, I definitely think it's has a lot to do with how people are diagnosing, like, where people are heading in society. I think we love to place people in different categories and love to assign them with whatever we think we should assign to them. Whereas when it comes to rape culture, when it comes to sexual violence and working with survivors, then it's not simply just this person needs to change. It's like our entire culture needs to be able to understand that, and respect is at the very basis of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We need to be respected. We need to feel secure. Security is a big part of being a human.
So do you think that we live within a rape culture?
In this society? No, I don't believe we do.
Do you know if Donald Trump himself has ever said that he forcibly did something to a woman against her will?
I don't. Do you?
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't need to wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the... I can do anything.
Gross. That's actually called sexual assault, and you can get 5 to 10 for it.
What policy did he dictate? Again,
he dictated that he was allowed to grab a woman's vagina without asking her.
So that's in law. That's substantiated in law.
That's rape culture. Get it? Why are you here, basically? Why are you
for community?
For community.
Yeah.
Okay.
To focus on food, water, and shelter.
Food, water, and shelter.
And where we get it so we can build a community.
Okay.
So that we can police ourselves.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on rape culture and Me Too movement and how it's...
In my opinion?
Yeah.
We want to give women guns.
Oh, okay.
So they can stop calling the man.
So if you ran across somebody with a gun, could you physically take it away from them?
You know what I mean? I'll do the best I can to defend myself.
Right, exactly. So if a woman did have a gun for self-defense, yes. What if it got taken away from her? What then?
You know what I mean?
Carry more guns.
No.
Yeah.
The media portrays sex relationships to be entirely casual.
Okay.
For example, just recently we're having a huge recollection towards rape culture within Aziz Ansari, as well as other comedians and big actors within the media industry that are completely and utterly validating sexual abuse and exploitation, which thus makes it normalized for everyone else.
Okay.
Because of course we are all consumers of media, whether it be movies, music, art.
Right.
And we just keep feeding into that system.
Okay.
By buying into their DVDs and Netflix and...
So you're the second person who said media.
Yeah.
And then another person just said that rape culture doesn't have anything to do with capitalism at all. It's human behavior. How do you think how the media portrays sex culture to consumers creates human behavior?
So as a prospective psychiatrist, we study human behavior and mannerisms and behavioral tendencies. Now, yes, we are all sexual human beings and we all feel the need to procreate.
Right.
But regardless of the fact, we also have a little thing called, I don't know, boundaries.
Okay.
Morality.
Okay.
Humanity.
Okay.
Consent has been and always will be sexy, regardless if you're in the human civilization or even an animal for that matter.
Okay.
The number one thing that we should always remember is that, yes, it is human tendency to want sex, but also being able to control our tendencies.
Do you think consent culture, is that like courtship?
To an extent.
Okay.
Now, what I would consider to be courtship within the matter is...
Because there's rape within courtship as
well,
especially in the animal world.
Exactly. Now, the fine line between consent and just taking someone else's body for granted is very, very thin. Of course, that is entirely based off of our educational system.
Okay.
And our media.
Okay.
And the stuff that we consume. And yes, it does feed into capitalism through media.
What brought you to the rally today?
Trying to get home, my bus got stopped. I decided to walk, and I saw it, and I am here, and I saw it. Yeah.
So you just jumped right in.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel now that you're amongst it without having planned for it?
It's awesome.
Makes it feel so awesome.
So many people all wanting the same thing, and it being a good thing.
Okay.
And all being in the same place
for
it.
Can you break down your experience for us? You were on your way home. You saw your bus stopped, and then you got off because you saw it happening.
Yeah,
to check what was going on.
I just walked home, and then I saw someone asked me directions to Pioneer Courthouse Square, and I showed them, and then I was walking that way myself.
Okay.
And it was just full of people, and I heard the end of the talking.
So you saw the collection first, right?
Yeah.
And then you decided to stay and participate because it held a positive message for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. And just in passing, thoughts on rape culture? How do you think it started? How do you think it's perpetuated? What are we going to do to solve it?
I think that it's kind of, it's all based in the objectification of women.
Okay.
Right? Because it comes from, there's aggressors on one side who think of women as objects, and it's so much easier to hurt someone if you think they're not a person.
Okay.
But then it also comes from seeing yourself as an object. And like it's almost a good thing if someone wants you as an object, because that's almost like the highest compliment you can get.
Being valued.
Yeah, is being valued not as a person, but just physically, just as an object to be wanted.
Okay.
And it's just awful from both of those sides, and both of them contribute to it. And it's not like both sexes necessarily. It's not like both sexes have their own thought that they're stuck in.
Okay.
That contribute.
But I never heard that much about you. Though you talk like you know what you're talking about, I don't know if I like you. I done had lots of things on my mind, but I never thought that much about you. Though you seem like you might be somebody to them, I don't think that I'd like you.
And we have now fractalized a prism of this experience of our sex culture that we know of as rape. Some people I spoke to did not want to acknowledge that rape even occurred with our society, and that they received these messages from higher-ups who depict this behavior within our culture. Some people I spoke to were willing to blame capitalism and what folks can purchase as part of their education as human beings that encourage this behavior. But I believe it was the response that told us treating another human being as if they were an object is what leads to the attitude that contributes to rape culture. Many things can facilitate rape culture, but it starts with an idea. It starts with an image and an inspiration that makes it allowable in somebody's mind and therefore that reality. As a reporter, I found clues that pointed me to the pursuit of sex, like our government points us to the pursuit of happiness, through a measurable and clearly defined channel. But within our sex culture, what is our Bill of Rights? Truths that I hold to be evident include that I, as an intersex person and a woman, am not accurately depicted by the media, nor is my experience, and yet so many people are familiar with that narrative, which includes me and other women. You can buy clothes, shoes, self-defense weapons, or subscriptions to porn channels. You can even buy time with women for sex in some places in the world. But can you purchase that most fundamental human need that seems to be intricately tied to how we understand sex, which is dignity? Loss of dignity seems to be a foundation of rape culture on both sides of the coin, which you cannot defend from or purchase. What I learned is that visibly treating each other with dignity will lead us to respect and ultimately consent and pleasure. And so the question is now, are you being treated with dignity, and how do you treat others? Is your courtship a means to an end or a means to a friend? Dignity as a practice. Consider it a courtship ritual, an investment of your time, or a valuable human behavior that we forgot with the rise of media, but do consider it and practice it out in the open. Dignity culture starts with a seed. It starts with an example. I think as human creators, we can be that example for others. This has been Lady Monte with Permutations, and in the most dignified way, I want you to stay sexy out there, and I'll see you on the streets.
Don't you want to?
He said, oh, for a minute there, I thought you were going to give me a thrill.
Said my life, but I never heard that much about you. You talk like you know what you're talking about. I don't know if I like you. I done had lots of things on my mind, but I never thought that much about you. Though you seem like you might be somebody to them, I don't think that I like you.
Tave Fache Drake and Brian Delaney teamed up with fellow podcaster St. James to make his top secret mushroom sage bisque. While cooking, they talked about toxic masculinity, the connection between music and cooking, and the power of preparing food for yourself as well as for those you care about.
We're here in the kitchen of St. James getting ready to make this month's highly anticipated top secret mushroom bisque.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. I'm really excited to make this for you guys. It feels a little bit more high pressure now that you said that. But yeah, I haven't shared the recipe with a lot of people. I hope that you guys like it and then you want to make it for your friends and family.
We're honored.
A lot of times I like to make it with risotto, or just like if you have some really nice bread and some good butter, that goes great with it too. You can make it with the basic ingredients, mushrooms, some kind of like butter substitute, and some flour. And then whatever vegetables you like, whatever spices you like, anybody can put it together.
You're going to give us enough information that someone could make a similar soup to their own taste at home.
Yeah, I think cooking is power. You know, if you're able to feed yourself, if you're able to use the resources around you so you don't have to be out like buying dinner every night. Yeah, I support that.
We should mention that St. James is wearing a t-shirt that says masculinity is a prison.
Can I say that this t-shirt gets me in so many conversations? The shirt is not speaking directly about men. It's speaking about this culture that's perpetrated by men and the definition of masculinity that we operate under. I think a lot of people refer to it as toxic masculinity, but then toxic masculinity is the prevailing version of masculinity. Therefore, masculinity is a prison.
There's nothing wrong with being masculine. I mean, I love men. Just don't be a jerk.
But see, that's the whole thing, is masculinity isn't necessarily owned by men. There are women who can be masculine, and there's men who can be feminine. There's all these things that box men into being a way that they think they have to be because it's perpetrated in pop culture and, like, be a man, right?
I feel most masculine when I'm wearing my cherry dress, to be frankly honest with y'all.
You feel most masculine?
Well, it kind of goes into just being who you are and just expressing yourself openly and honestly and not being concerned whether it's masculine or feminine that I'm acting. It's just I'm being. That's how I interpret your shirt.
I grew up, I have five sisters, and I was the youngest, basically their doll. And since I was young, I know how to like braid hair and paint nails, and that's not necessarily, I think, anything that like detracts from my masculinity. In fact, I don't think that makes you less of a man.
But I was going to say, it is something that society dictates, and I think we've sort of come to the understanding that we're not getting anywhere boxing in men or women. And really, all of that is being dictated by a consumer culture. If you feel insecure about yourself as a woman, you're going to buy more products. You're going to stifle the real you in there so that you are then a commodity for this toxic man that we're, as a society, also propagating because we can make more money off of them by them consuming masculine whatnot and then using women. So there.
And we got to cook a soup. Yeah. All right, so to catch us up. What did you do?
I chopped up the mushrooms, garlic, and onions. put that aside with some mushroom caps and as much garlic as an individual would want to use, and then you can come back to that later. The first thing, you're going to have some melted butter in the bottom of a pot. You shouldn't have it too hot. You should have it about medium low. And then once the butter is like fully in liquid form, you add your garlic, onions, and mushrooms. And then let the onions be your notifier. As soon as they start to get like a little translucent and really soaking up that butter, you're going to know it's time for the flour.
Now, these mushrooms, did you and Tavi pick them up at the farmer's market last week?
We did. They're these beautiful mini shiitake. Like, usually I have to chop up the mushrooms too, but they're so small. I think they're the perfect size for this soup. The thing about cooking, and especially soups, it's all about timing. It can go a little bit more. I'm going to go grab the flour before it gets truly ready.
You're measuring out your cornstarch.
And so basically we're about to create this mushroom roux. And so we're just going to throw this cornstarch on top, and it's just going to make it all really chunky and brown. And it's going to create this paste. Once it gets really, really pasty, turn it down a little bit. That's when we're going to add the cream and the broth.
And you are constantly stirring this.
Yeah, because you don't want it to burn at the bottom.
That's right. So because you're using straight up butter, you would have to really be careful about it. And one thing we've done in our family is we'll stick a little bit of olive oil in with it to help keep the butter from burning. Have you ever done that?
I have done that. Unfortunately, today, I don't think I have any olive oil.
What? How dare you?
How dare you? I would like to get it really, really pasty. Because once you put that broth in, there's no going back.
There's no going back.
All right, here we go with the broth. Just want to put enough to match the amount that's in the bowl already. But you don't want to add too much broth in right at the beginning, or it will take that much longer for it to thicken. See, it just keeps thickening.
So it's just by doing this multiple times and getting an eye for when it's right.
Yeah, and I used to work at the shelter, and I've made this soup, I don't know, hundreds of times. And so you kind of figure out how to get in there. And so at this point, I'm about to put in half these herbs, and I won't reveal what herbs I'm putting in.
This is interesting for me to see too, because I've always made a roux before as the starting thing. So to see you sticking the flour in afterwards is really neat. And there was no clumping that happened.
No, that's why you got to make sure that all that cornstarch and butter are a real nice paste. This is one of my favorite parts of the soup, is before you actually bisque it, and it's all mixed in there together. And then it's just like five people in a music studio, and each of them are like doing their part. And so, like, you know, you go, you mix in the guitars, and then you have the drums, and then you have the singer, and each of them is an individual thing. And this is like everybody in the studio recording their individual parts. And then we're about to like hear the final track.
Great analogy.
And then I'm going to bring a blender over here. Once you have your bass and all the band members are in the studio and they're working together, you're going to take a couple of scoops. You don't want to fill a blender more than like a third of the way at most, just because it's going to get hot and want to come out. And then I just add a little bit of water or a little bit of milk if you want. And then I blend it just to smooth it out. And then you got to do it in parts, just because, like I said, you don't want to do the whole thing at one time. Your blender will spit like really hot liquid at you. It's not a good time. So here we go. The blending is all done. I put all the contents of the blender into a separate bowl. I'm about to move the bisque into the pot. Okay, then we're gonna turn this back on and keep it at a low heat.
How long would you cook that for?
So the first part of this, just until you start seeing like those bubbles come through, you want it to be like barely simmering. I'll then add some half and half, the rest of the spices, and then vegetables that I want floating around in there. In this case, just mushrooms and garlic cloves. And you'll want to like let it simmer. I like to let it simmer for 45 minutes, an hour, just so the flavor really gets integrated.
And those are the same spices you put into the roux to sort of layer the soup with flavor.
Yeah, definitely. And so like the flavor is in the soup and the bisque. You know, you'll taste the sage. The sage is the most prominent spice. But there will also be like the flavor in the cloves and the mushroom caps. Usually it's like a little bit grayer than this, I added a lot of turmeric.
I thought we weren't supposed to be sharing ours.
Well, yeah, I was about to say there's about 15 spices in here, so you guys can have one or two. And then every now and then you're going to want to check on it. If you see it kind of starting to like get clumpy or thick while it's simmering, just add a little bit of water and let it keep going.
Well, while that's cooking, so you mentioned working at a shelter. Can you further educate us on that?
A few years ago, I was working at a shelter as the food coordinator, which meant I cooked the food, but then also organized the donations from different organizations. That was one of the most fulfilling jobs that I've ever had.
And this is here in Portland?
Yeah, here in Portland. They're through the Salvation Army. It's a shelter for women and their children who are victims of domestic abuse and need a safe space to be able to find housing and find work away from a situation that could be dangerous. And so from the perspective of somebody who provides food, it was really important for me to be able to present this food from a place of caring.
In my opinion, you're the epitome of peace, love, and soup.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a really good note to all of us to just make sure that we're giving of ourselves when we can. And it just makes us all a little closer.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you have something that you're good at, to use yourself as a resource. For my friend Kim Hack, she's a really wonderful human being. She runs Kitchen Share. You know, like the tool library.
Yes.
She runs a kitchen library where you can check out different equipment. And she's doing something where people can come and teach community cooking classes. In fact, Kim actually asked me to do a soup class when we first met. And if you know how to make something, you guys should teach a class too.
We've made a few soups.
It will be another wonderful opportunity for all of us to collaborate. And yeah, and we better get back to our soup.
So checking the soup. You can tell the soup is looking good. Let's give it 10 more minutes. So this recipe is probably enough for around 4 to 8 people, depending on how much you want to eat, and also what you're pairing it with.
But it is hearty enough to eat on its own.
By itself, and like I said, if nothing else, let's add some bread to the mix.
Or a light salad if you're just looking for a little bit of something to accompany
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly. I have cooked this as a stand-in for gravy, and a lot of people don't necessarily know that it's not gravy, and so they'll use it with their mashed potatoes.
That's a great idea.
And so then I'll really thicken it.
So it looks like it's done, and you're dishing her up.
Yeah, usually I garnish it with chives and green onions and then like those big mushroom caps. And here we go. Do you want one scoop or two?
I'll take two, please.
Ooh, I like it with the scallion.
So yes, he topped it with scallions, grated cheese, salt and pepper. Oh, and a spicy sauce.
Yeah, a little dollop of chili sauce.
So what's your reaction, Tabe?
I just don't even know where to begin. I didn't know what this consistency was really supposed to be, and it's thick, but it's definitely not as thick as a gravy. Oh, I don't even, I honestly, I'm slightly speechless.
Are you going to make this when you get home?
Oh, yes, I sure am. I think it should be something that should go as an accompaniment to every meal.
All right, let me try, let me dig in. St. James, this is incredible. I love the bisque. Consistency. It is so unique to other soups we've done for our podcast. That butter, the half and half. And generally, I'm not a super fan of creamy soups, but I think it's delicious.
I am nuts about creamy soups, but this one doesn't taste too rich.
Right. And so, Tavi, slow down and let us all have a taste.
So, my roommate Harper just got home.
All right, welcome, Harper.
Thank you.
I know Harper is always a straight shooter. He's going to tell me what he thinks.
Wow. Okay. You've been holding out on me, bud.
Had you not had his mushroom bisque before?
Yeah, this is the first time. It's pretty incredible.
St. James, thank you so much for making this incredible soup for us.
Yeah, it was a treat to be with you and cook.
Thanks for having me on the show. I believe that cooking especially is a labor of love, and you do it for people that you care about, and I'm glad to have been able to make this soup for you guys.
So where can our listeners find you?
I have a show called What Are You Listening To? And also the St. James Show with KBOO.
Well, you have a podcast too. Tell our listeners about that.
It's called People Are the Worst. And it sounds a little bit drab maybe. But the idea that anybody is capable of having a bad day or being their worst self, that you can get behind the idea of this podcast, that we can all connect over like the people that we wish that we weren't sometimes and aspire to be better people. I'm so glad you guys came over to taste this soup.
I have to go pick up my child. I do.
All right, we'll let you go.
That was Tave Fache-Drake and Brian Delaney. You can check out their podcast by visiting kboo.fm and searching for Peace, Love, and Soup. Next up, Kristen Thiels shares this month's She Raw Solution. It is a monthly biography of women past and present that was inspired by Maria Teresa Hart's article, She Raw and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published in The Atlantic. Today, she talks about power, mystery, and innovation around food and recipes, highlighting the woman who became the cook of the civil rights movement.
Because of the waves of protests over the last year, I've become interested not only in the people shouting out front, but in the massive efforts of those working outside the lighting of the speakers' podiums and those working along the edges of the marches, like the people who provide on-the-spot medical and legal assistance to protesters, childcare for the marchers' kids, and meals for those spending long hours away from home. During the civil rights movement, Georgia Gilmore was one such hero. To be clear, Georgia was also on the front lines. In fact, her testifying in court about the racist structure of public transportation in 1950s America cost her job as a cook. Thankfully, Georgia, then in her mid-30s, was offered advice by Martin Luther King Jr. himself, who was a fan of her cooking. He used to place a special order for her chicken every time VIPs came to town to meet with him. He suggested she open a restaurant in her home. Not only did her place provide the perfect safe meeting space for civil rights strategists and national leaders, for example, King brought along the likes of Robert F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson to Georgia's home, but it also allowed her to develop what was basically a catering company for protests. Georgia made and sold food to activists. The money she made went right back into the movement. During the 381-day Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 and to 1956, Georgia's earnings helped to pay the insurance, gas, and vehicle repairs for the alternative public transportation system that sprung up. People boycotting the main bus system couldn't afford to not go to work, so they took Georgia-funded buses instead. Georgia's strategy was brilliantly inclusive. John T. Edge, who studies the intersection of Southern food and culture out of University of Mississippi, explained to NPR early last year how Georgia's cooking mobilized so many people. Gilmore organized other African-American women to make and sell food at beauty salons, cab stands, and churches. Their work, in turn, inspired other women to organize groups of food vendors. Quote, "She offered these women, many of whose grandmothers were born into slavery, a way to contribute to the cause that would not raise suspicions of white employers who might fire them from their jobs, or white landowners who might evict them from the houses they rented." These women came to be known as the Club from Nowhere, a reference to their under-the-radar tactics. Quote, "It was like, where did this money come from? It came from nowhere." Again, though Georgia mobilized countless women in behind-the-scenes work, neither her face nor her voice was unknown. She attended meetings and marches and even testified for King during his February 1956 trial for unlawful conspiracy brought by Montgomery County. Reverend Al Dixon told NPR in 2005, quote, "Everybody could tell you Georgia Gilmore didn't take no junk. You pushed her too far, she would say a few bad words. If you pushed her any further, she would hit you." Still, Georgia is best remembered as what NPR called, quote, "the fearless cook of the civil rights movement." In fact, the very day of her death in 1990, when she was 70 years old, she spent the morning cooking chicken and macaroni cheese. The food was for those marching in observation of the 25th anniversary of the Civil Rights March from Selma. Sadly, the food ended up going to those who came to mourn her. Its immediate function was different than Georgia had intended, but her gift to the public was still the same, sustenance that far surpassed the nutrients on the plate.
Like so many women of her generation and those before, Georgia likely cooked from memory. Of course, for African Americans, there are a couple of glaring reasons why they didn't keep written recipes. Those were, obviously, slavery and the fact that literacy was illegal for a long time for African Americans. The first known cookbook by an African American woman is Domestic Cookbook, containing a careful selection of useful receipts for the kitchen, by Melinda Russell. It's a 39-page pamphlet printed in 1866. One of the first people to be set free from slavery in Virginia, Russell intended to resettle in Liberia, Africa. But after she was robbed, she found herself on a career path in first Virginia as a cook and lady's companion and then owner of a laundry, and then in Tennessee as owner of a boarding house and pastry shop. Her recipes were for puff pastries, rose cakes, catfish fricassee, and sweet onion custard, a complete mix of highlighting her southern home and European cosmopolitan exploration. Tony Tipton Martin, a food historian, told the New York Times that the cookbook is, quote, an emancipation proclamation for Black cooks. She said, quote, in isolation, Melinda's book might appear to be an aberration, but in the context of the Black written cookbooks that followed, many of which reflected a sophisticated international kitchen, Mrs. Russell's cookbook dispels the notion of a universal African-American food experience, which is why the term soul food doesn't work for so many of us. Cookbooks by African-Americans have largely been left out of the publishing world and the historical record. According to an article in the New Republic, between 1987 and 2012, 50,000 cookbooks were published. In contrast, the David Walker Lupton African American Cookbook Collection, housed at the University of Alabama and considered one of the largest of its kind, contains only about 500 cookbooks. Interestingly, according to that same article, African American cooks are benefiting from modern media. Quote, it's easier for Black cooks to circumvent traditional cookbook publishing and share their recipes, preparation techniques, and culinary trends via online and traditional TV shows, blogs, and podcasts. After all these years, necessity is still the mother of invention for Black cooks in America. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
And now Lynn Finch shares another story with us. Lynn is a storyteller with Portland Story Theater, and this month she shares her story called Defying Age.
February is my birthday month, and I'm going to be 66 this year, so age has been a lot on my mind. I can remember when I first saw my mom as getting older. I was living in Alaska, and I usually saw her only once or twice a year. As she answered the door, she was in her mid-60s, and I would have been in my mid-40s. Mom had always looked the same to me for as long as I could remember. Young, fit, not a wrinkle in sight. But that day, I saw graying hair, a few extra pounds, sagging skin, and a face that was creased with laugh lines. That will never happen to me, I said to myself. I'm teaching exercise classes, I eat healthy foods, and I use the best herbal products on my skin. I'm going to be youthful forever. I can keep my body from aging, I'm sure of it. Little did I know that my mom had probably thought the same thing, when in reality, we have absolutely no power to stop the biological clock from ticking. Age creeps up on you, silently, disguised, effectively hiding, until one day it begins to appear in small incremental ways, when you least expect it. Now, I intellectually get that aging and the deterioration of the physical body is part of life, but when the reality of it hits you, it's pretty devastating. I'm part of a generation of women who were raised with the belief that our youth and our appearance were the most valuable asset we had. Our connection to a husband and a successful life and career, a key aspect of our identity. We were indoctrinated with messages about how to stay youthful looking, and they led us to believe that we could, in fact, be forever young. For most of my life, I could rely on my body and looking like myself. I took great care to be fit. Even after pregnancies, I regained the body I knew and loved. Over the years, I could count on a little bit of exercise and perhaps a bit of dieting to immediately bring me back to toned muscles and great skin. I followed all the rules in those beauty magazines. As a teenager, I learned how to apply moisturizer correctly, blending it over my skin with upward strokes to prevent old, saggy skin. I did the exercises to keep my face muscles firm. As I got older, I stayed active and became extremely health conscious. I looked younger than I was, and I was confident in my ability to stay this way well into old age. The wrinkles and that muffin top that had plagued my mom wasn't going to happen to me. It was like I had a Dorian Gray painting of my likeness. It was aging and showing wear and tear, but my physical body wasn't going to. I managed pretty well into my 50s. I'd held on to a youthful appearance. I felt strong and vibrant. And then a veil hiding the inevitable lifted. Menopause. Yes, those hot flashes suck, and the mood swings a pain in the ass. But that was nothing to the loss of muscle tone, saggy skin, and the inability to lose weight that suddenly happened. I knew there had to be something I could do, so I made an appointment with a women's health specialist. I'll never forget the sinking feeling I had when she told me that no, there was nothing she could do to help me. You just have to learn to live with it, she said, unless you want to try Botox or surgery. So began the time of camouflage, a closet full of 3/4 length sleeves, turtlenecks, and tunic tops that dropped well past the waistline. The use of mascara to color the few eyelashes I had left, and makeup to help make those age spots disappear. I even purchased expensive skin serum to plump my skin and disguise the wrinkles. I increased my efforts to maintain the muscles I had left, and I managed the weight gain. And for a few more years, I felt good about how I looked and comfortable. Then I seemed to turn a corner, and no matter what I did or had done in the past to keep myself young-looking, worked anymore. I was in my mid-60s, and my hands started to ache after a day of gardening. Varicose veins, which I'd never had, suddenly appeared overnight. My energy level dropped. Evenings out to listen to music, well, they ended when my night vision failed. There was stiffness and aches and pains, and when I looked in the mirror, my mom looked back at me. I could no longer deny the obvious. I was getting old. It really hit me one day when I was getting my hair cut. Paul was wrapping up, brushing off my neck and face, when he glanced down and without a word, quickly trimmed off one of those white chin hairs. I was mortified. So I've gone through the stages of denial and anger about physically aging, and I'm grateful that I still have reasonably good health and only a few senior moments. I'm in the process of learning to adapt and accept my situation and limitations and ponder what lies ahead. Spending time working in my garden is helpful, and always seems to offer great metaphors for life. Just the other day, I was admiring all the mushrooms helping to break down the mulch and enrich the earth. Decay, it's a necessary part of the cycle of life. I'm hopeful now that the decline of my body will reveal a rich wisdom inside. I feel like a new cycle is about to begin, something interesting and different, even if the transition now is kind of bumpy. The person that I am within was never really defined by my physical body, no matter how much I may have believed it. That was just a sad illusion. So now I think that aging, no matter how uncomfortable, allows us to become who we really are and what we came here for. I also have realized that the gifts of getting older would never happen without being nudged by our physical decline to slow down, reflect, and do things differently. Most importantly, I've learned to be grateful for the wrinkles, my crepe-like skin, and an occasional pesky white chin hair. Being a crone might not be so bad after all.
Gold will turn to gray, youth will fade away. They'll never care about you, call you old and ill away. They'll never care about you, call you old and ill away.
And now Denise Kowalczyk chats with blogger and published writer Jolie Brownell. Jolie started a blog called Me Too Girl. It is written for teens and tackles topics like bullying and finding your place in the world.
Jolie, welcome to The Politics of Living.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
You know, it was such a treat. I was thinking about all those months ago when we met at a women's networking group, and it took us many tries to get you here in the studio and scheduling and all that stuff with the holidays and such. So I'm really thrilled that we finally could make this happen.
I am too.
Was that the beginning of you getting out in the world to promote your upcoming book?
I think it was, yeah, pretty much right when I launched October. Okay. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about who you are, where you come from, a little bit of your background.
Sure. I am now 18 years old. Back when I published my book, I was 17. But I am originally from Haiti. I was adopted and have been here in the U.S. since then. I am the second oldest of six kids, and so I have a big family. But yeah, I'm a graduate from Sunset High School.
And so I saw that you have a blog. It's called Me Too Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And on it are images. And are they thoughts, poems? How would you describe the content on the blog?
Similar to my book. So it's a collection of writing on all things girl empowerment.
Well, what motivated you to do this?
I've always loved writing. And just through my life experiences of being bullied and having words being used towards me to hurt, I decided that I wanted to use my words specifically to help empower and lift people up.
Mm, that's very, very powerful. Wow. And are you the only contributor to the blog, or do you have other folks?
Currently, I'm the only one, but I am looking for new voices to include.
And when you come up with your content, how do you come up with your theme or your topic?
They usually center, just similar to my book, around the four main topics. So body acceptance, confidence, goal setting, and healthy relationships.
And I pulled one of those pieces off of your blog, and I was hoping you could read that for us.
Yeah. Here we go. Unite, they say, unite. But I say no. Unite, they say, unite. But unite in what? They unite, but they unite in hate. So again, I say no. Unite, they say, unite. But unite with who? They unite, but they unite with restrictions. So again, I say no. I will not unite unless we unite in love. Love for people of color. Love for women. Love for the LGBTQ. Love for our human rights. Love for our atmosphere. Love for the animals. Love for justice, love for feminism, love for the outcasts, love for everyone. We must unite in love or not at all.
I like that. Thanks for reading that. So you published a book. Is this your first book?
Yes, it is.
Oh my gosh. Tell me about that experience.
It was a crazy one. Right when I'm coming up to start getting preparing to graduate for high school, my parents encouraged me to take a gap year. And for my gap year, I decided that the first thing I wanted to do was self-publish my book. So I went for it. I went out into my community and sought out professionals who knew what they were doing and asked them for help. And together we were able to bring about and publish Me Too.
That's a really great accomplishment. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I have a friend of mine who, for the first time ever, published a couple of books. And it's pretty remarkable when people want to put some of their creative stuff out in the world. It's a little bit easier from when I was your age. That was quite a few years back. It wasn't so easy to publish. Did you find the process pretty easy to do?
Only because I was able to find an awesome group of people willing to help me. If I was doing it on my own, it would have been a lot more difficult. So, yeah.
Who were some of those folks?
Well, my mentor, Lee, she helped me with the copyright and the legal side. My great family friend, Sally Morrow, she helped with the design and the cover and the interior. Some other family friends, Jennifer and Stephanie, they helped me with the editing process.
So I guess the big question for me now is, what's next?
What's next?
for you?
For me, well, besides going to college, just continuing to go out and pursue my dreams of empowering girls.
And are you going to look at some professional opportunities to do that?
Yeah, I mean, my dream job is to become a motivational speaker. So just getting out there and building my platform.
I could totally see you doing that.
Yeah.
And are you going to be offering any speaking opportunities to share the good words and some of your wisdom?
Yeah, I've been being able to find some places to be keynote speakers, and I'm also working and collaborating with Girls Inc. organization that is right here in Portland to establish and create a workshop series called Me Too Girl, and they will also focus on the same topics of my book and empower the girls here in Portland.
I love Girls Incorporated, an amazing organization to be aligned with. So I guess the final question, it's a big one.
Yes.
Actually, it's not. how can folks keep in touch with you?
Well, they can go to my website, metoogirl.com, and they can find the contact page, and I will respond quickly. I love any opportunity to collaborate and just continue to spread good messages out into the world.
Well, I'm hoping to recruit you to collaborate on the politics of living, but we'll talk about that off mic. Thanks so much, Jolie.
Thank you for having me.
For more information about Jolie's book and blog, visit kbu.fm and search for The Politics of Living, episode 12. Well, this is all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Lynn Finch, Denise Kowalczyk, Tave Fache-Drake, and Lady Monte. Also, thanks to our technical editor, Liam Delta, and webpage manager, Vicky Mazzone. Thanks for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Bonnie Michelle. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Liam Delta, editor of The Politics of Living. KBOO offers all kinds of great programming. Be sure to check out Bread and Roses, Friday evenings from 6 to 7. The Collective has been on the air since 1978, making it the longest-running feminist radio show in the country. Della Ray and other contributors give voice to those working for social justice and equity, globally and locally.
Thank you.